documenting the crisis of our republic, waging war on the new world order. This is Govern America. Govern America.
From just south of the Great Lakes capital city, covering all of North America via satellite, micro FM stations all across the country, and streaming live from FEMA Region 5 and Michigan Planning Region 2. This is Govern America. I'm Darren Weeks, along with Vicki Davis, here with you on this 25th of November 2017. Nice to have you with us once again as we are post-Thanksgiving now. And yes, we are live for those that are listening on Saturday morning anyway. I know a number of different outlets replay it during throughout the week, but we are live on Saturday morning. Yeah, so if it's the 25th of November, 2017, you are not listening to a replay. I know the reason why I'm stressing that is because a lot of people, I think we're probably one of the few shows that actually are going live right now. I think most of the Patriot broadcasting, what would you call it, machine? I think they're mostly in replays now, which, you know, I understand. A lot of people are wanting to spend time with their family, and we're back to business here because there's too much going on in the world. Hey, good morning, Vicki.
Good morning, Darren.
Yeah, you were just telling me just before the show about the Democratic Order, this buzz phrase that keeps popping up everywhere.
Yeah, the liberal Democratic Order. And where I got that term was that I watched a panel discussion between Madeleine Albright, Condoleezza Rice, and Nikki Haley. And basically, they're talking about their crisis of globalization because the Bush, or not the Bush, the Trump administration wants to cut both the UN budget and the State Department budget.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're
Sounds
kind
good
of
to me.
In crisis, and I'm just enjoying the hell out of it.
Yeah, well, you know what? This liberal Democratic Order sounds like another buzz phrase for a new world order. They just don't want to incite those conspiracy theorists out there who are right every time, it seems. But anyway, yeah, I watched the same thing after you sent it to me, and in fact, I think I have some audio here of that particular thing.
Okay, well, before we get to that, let me just say I found a report of anthologies that was posted on the Foreign Affairs website, which is the website for the Council on Foreign Relations, and it is a series of articles by different authors on the liberal democratic order, and I'll send the link so you can post it in the show notes, and I really recommend that everybody go get that link and take a look at those articles, because I think that's really an important collection.
All right, very good. Yeah, I wasn't going to just launch right into that conference just yet, because I do have some, I have some bad news, Vicki. It's not good at all. In fact, the more I look at some of this stuff that I come across, the more I've come to the conclusion that society is doomed. I discovered recently that we have an upcoming generation that seems like they cannot function. They cannot function in society. And this has really got me worried, because in the event that something really, really bad happens, what are we going to do? You know, as the older generation gets older, you know, the resilient generation, the generation that's been through tough times and have had to weather the storms and do things like can and garden and, I don't know, you know, real work to get by. We have a generation of millennials. And I'm speaking broadly. I mean, obviously, not all of them are like this, but they just can't function. They're soft. They're soft. They're gentle. They're delicate. They're little snowflakes that can't function in society. And the problem with this is that we're headed for some tough times in America. You know, I know that you know this, and I know a lot of our listeners know this, but it's unavoidable. I mean, there's going to be some seriously bad stuff happen at some point, and I think the near future. It's just the way it's been engineered.
Yeah. And yeah, they bifurcated our society to where there is the wealthy and their high-tech cadre of workers in the high-tech society, and the rest of society, they are leaving basically out in the cold, you know, is what I think.
Let me tell
doing.
You what I found. Mm-hmm. I was, maybe you're aware that this is going on, but I wasn't. I don't know why, for some reason I popped over to the Anti-Federalist papers, which we have a link off of our website. So I landed on thefederalistpapers.org, and I'm going through the Federalist Papers, and I noticed that on the side there was a suggested article. Which says, so now professional cuddling is a thing. Have you ever heard of this? Yes.
Professional cuddling?
I'm not kidding you. It's professional cuddling. And they say, when your ne'er-do-well son graduates from Ball State with his bachelor's degree in liberal studies, now there's a job waiting for him out in liberal land. Apparently, the industry of cuddling is finding a niche among millennial business and professional workers. And yes, it's as creepily uncomfortable as you think. Professional cuddling is growing in urban areas, fueled by young people entering the world who simply don't know how to function without constant reassurance. Now, as I read this, I think of the multiple years. I think back in the 80s when we were fighting the affective education programs in the schools, namely here in Michigan, the Michigan model for a comprehensive school health education. This, you know, they get the students in the classroom and get them in contact with their feelings and all of this. And academics aren't really that important, but it's this emotional stuff. And I thought, you know, this is really the problem, is affective education. Decades of affective education is affecting these people. Really, the more I think about it, I think it's even deeper than that. I think it's more recent than that, because we've had affective education, and we've had people be born and not be affected by these programs quite to this extent. I think this, the more I look at it, I think that this is more of a recent social media phenomenon.
Well, you know what, Darren? I would agree with that. They're really doing social engineering on our children in schools. Mm-hmm. The neuro-linguistic programming, the group think, so that children never learn to think on their own. Everybody gets an award. You know, there are no differences. No, nobody is allowed to excel. At least it's not acknowledged, because everybody is the same, right? Mm-hmm. And what you do really when you do that is you destroy your best and brightest. The ones that are not as bright, they never know the difference. And I'm really sorry for saying that. It sounds cruel, but it's a fact, you know.
There's a video that a Business Insider evidently did a tweet on this. They put out a tweet with the video. And the video, when you look at this, it shows two full-grown women. I mean, they're millennial age, I guess. One of them, they're laying on the floor together. The one who is the cuddler is laying on her back. And the other woman, who is the client, is laying beside her with her arm around her. They're touching each other, embracing each other. And the client has her leg over the other woman and between her legs. and they're interlocked, they're interbraced. Now what?
That sounds creepily homosexual.
It's the strangest. I've been telling my whole family about this. Okay, because I discovered it. I think yesterday or the day before. I think it was. Yeah, it was yesterday. I discovered this, and this is honestly, this is the weirdest thing I have ever seen. Here I got a soundbite. This is a little short clip from the video where the actual most of the video is just playing music and showing them, you know, touching each other.
please.
But this is the professional cuddler describing the experience.
During a cuddler session, it's a safe space. It's a space where they get to explore touch. More likely than not, they're not getting the level of touch that they need in their everyday life.
Yeah, so they're looking at this like a therapy session. Now these
buy a dog, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah. these professional cuddlers, I've done a little reading. I spent a little time on this because it just fascinated me. Because it social experiments, social, and again, I take it back to social media. I think what's going on here, and this is just me speculating, but what I think is going on is we have this brand new, and it really is a very new phenomenon. Really, the internet is a new phenomenon. We haven't had the internet very long, but we certainly haven't had social media for very long. So we're in a situation where people spend all of their time on Facebook, on all these other, you know, Instagram, Twitter, all these various social media services, and I put that word in quotes, which provide some kind of artificial connection with other people. You're not making real connections. You feel like you're making real connections at the time, maybe. You think in your mind that it's actually keeping you in touch with other people. And keeping you in touch with people that maybe you would have fallen out of touch with. So you feel like you're being a real social animal as you're on these sites. But in reality, you're not getting any touch. You're not getting any handshakes or hugs. You're not engaging in the things that people usually do in a normal civilized society. And as a result, now these people are feeling depressed. They're feeling touch starved. So what are they doing? They're hiring professionals now to go around and touch them themselves. and they stress, you know, that it's all non-sexual. You know, you're not, no sex is involved, no sex is allowed. But I mean, I don't know if that's. There's these companies. There's more than one of them. They're popping up all over the place. Apparently, there is a one that's called Cuddlist.com. Co-founder and director of trainer Madelone Guinzazzo on cuddling. She says professional cuddling is very new, and like all things, it is evolving. My years of experience coaching communication with healthcare professionals and facilitating workshops on cuddling and consent with groups of people has taught me volumes about how people can genuinely connect very deeply, very quickly. This is a skill set that can be taught and practiced. It has everything to do with boundaries and the ability to consistently communicate with them, in positive ways. When we do this, it creates the safety necessary for tenderness and vulnerability to show up. The combination is magical, and there is a need for it. Go ahead.
That sounds like a modernized love-in. 1960s love-in.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that, did they used to do that in the 60s? I was born in 70, so.
Oh, yeah.
I remember hearing about it.
Hippies would get together and have a love-in. And
well, wasn't that orgies? Weren't those?
Well, that's touching, isn't it? No, I never went to one because I was a little bit too young. This was going on when I was in high school. But, you know, I did, I just remember it, you know, the hippies having their love-ins. And
I remember hearing about it.
And there were orgies, you know, and communes and everything else. So.
Honestly, Vicki, this has me, as reading about this on various places on different sites, looking at some of these profiles of the whack jobs that actually do this, and frankly, I say whack jobs, but you look at them, they look like normal people, most of them. So there are a few that, you know, like scary people, but mostly it's it looks like just ordinary, down to earth, you know, normal people,
but twisted and deviant.
Well, they don't look deviant.
Deviance is in the mind, right?
It's not hard for me to see. Well, they're mostly females.
Sure, of course.
And I think a lot of college students, honestly, because college students, frankly, are so desperate because of the high price of college. Now, it's such a scam that, you know, people can't even, they're basically, when you decide to go to college, you're almost sentencing yourself to a lifetime of debt. You're being a debt slave. College is a huge bubble, in my opinion. And at some point, it's got to pop. But be that as it may, you've got these people doing this, and it's not just college students. But, I mean, these professional cuddlers are making like $80 an hour, or at least that's what the session costs. And
what a con.
Like $35 of that goes to the site to have them listed so people can find them. They have to pay like I'm trying to remember what the price, $250 I think, to go through the professional cuddling training. I have no idea what that involves. I'm guessing how to handle situations. Probably hygiene is covered, I would imagine, you know, but
probably the neuro-linguistic programming, or the, what do they call that, ASM, you know, the women whisperers.
Yeah, I've seen some of that on the internet. What the heck is that?
It's a way of speaking that apparently is soothing and calming to people. Now, it has the opposite effect on me. It makes me absolutely go into a rage, and I can't tell you why.
I can't hear what you're saying!
From my point of view, it's more like, you know, get normal or get out. You know, I don't want to hear your whispering and soft and just makes me sick. It just, there's one woman, the one woman where I finally looked it up, because I would hear women speaking like this, and I think it came out of marketing, marketing for women, because I was told by a guy one time that women are the most effective marketers, and I think it's because they can use a blend of sexuality that's not sexual per se, but use of their feminine attributes, and ASM is the use of those feminine attributes. Anyway, this woman, her name is Lily Eckelstein or something like that. She's like president of the teachers union or something like that, having to do with education. But I can't help it. I just go into an absolute rage because it is so phony and manipulative to me.
Yeah, so this thing, I don't know where these ideas come from. But it says, our society is hungry to feel close to ourselves and others in healthy ways. Cuddling is a vehicle for this. We have done so much in the last 50 years to protect people from unhealthy, abusive touch. Now we are ready to discover new ways to provide healthy, nurturing touch. Separating it from sex is essential. We need to experience physical closeness as adults without the complications and pressure of sex. Cuddling is about being able to relax into whatever we are feeling in the moment in the presence of another person who sees that we are good. This is tremendously nurturing, even healing in and of itself. All human beings have bodies and emotions. We need to feel a sense of physical and emotional safety and belonging with others. This is the experience our cuddlists are trained to provide. It is a pioneering work. We are bringing something new and needed to those who are ready to try it. We don't expect it to be right for everyone, and we are adamant about no one being touched in any way they don't want to be. But what we do believe is that every time one person becomes more relaxed, happy, and connected, it ripples out and improves things for the rest of us.
It kind of sounds like a progression from massage to complete weirdness.
Yeah, there's.
I don't know.
I don't.
That's just like a bridge too far, as far as I'm concerned.
It's crazy, is what it is. there's a site, a company called the Snuggle Buddies.
You know what? Probably your tax dollars paid for that, because it's the research in social interaction.
Well, yeah, it definitely is an experiment. I mean, I think all of society now, because of, and again, I come back to the social media aspect of it. I think this is an outgrowth. I think, Vicky, social media is making people sick. Social media. People have forgotten how to function with each other. It's social media that's causing the divisions. It's social media. The media plays the news media plays a big part of it, honestly. But social media reinforces all of the things that you believe. It's programmed to do that. The algorithms are made that way, to throw back at you viewpoints that you agree with. By virtue of the fact that you go through and like these posts, it says, well, they like that, so I'm going to give them more of that person. And, they like this, so I'm going to give them more of that person. And before you know it, you have an echo chamber, and you never have to be challenged. And so when you are challenged, you're unable to deal with it. And when you're behind the safety of a keyboard and a computer screen, you don't have to face somebody else in real society. You don't know how to deal with composure, maintaining composure. So when people are out and about and they finally do, they just lose their crap.
Yeah, you know what? That's very interesting, because I've encountered several younger people, you know, pertaining to issues on the computer, and we used to laugh and call them value-added guys, because they want to charge you for value-added. Like my friend Michael that started TVOI News, he had a value-added guy working for him building the website. The guy wanted to charge him $500 to put a donate button on the website.
Wow.
You know, take a month and $500 to put a donate button on.
Oh, my
and,
word.
And the thing was, Michael didn't know any different, you know. And so I told him, Michael, fire that guy. I don't care what it takes. If I have to have my son write you a website.
It's a copy and paste. You just copy and paste code.
Exactly. I said, you know, but anyway, when I was talking to this guy, I talked to the young value-added guy, and I was going to try to reach him on a professional-to-professional level. And he came at me like a troll on the internet.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I had to
cut into his business model.
Yeah, right back at him. You know, say, don't you ever talk to me that way. And ultimately,
and better yet, just don't talk to him.
Yeah, well, ultimately, you know, as soon as I hung up the phone, I called Michael and I said, fire that guy. Because he's a crook, but he yeah. didn't know how to interact with me on a professional level. When I challenged him on, you know, the $500 donate button, he came back with an attack.
That's crazy, 500.
And of course, I'm not one to, you know, that is a shrinking violet. You know, if I'm attacked, I attack back. So,
yeah.
But it surprised him. It really surprised him. He thought he was going to, you know, bully me or something, I guess.
Well, it doesn't surprise me.
Mm-hmm. They don't know how to interact with people. I totally, that was my point. They don't know how to interact with people.
The Snuggle Buddies is one site. Then there's CuddleUpToMe.com is another one. Then there's CertifiedCuddlers.com. These are evidently popping up all over the place. And you know, I guess, as I said, I think most of the professional cuddlers are women. It's a quick way of getting a little money for people. But it's bizarre. I'll put these links in the show notes for anybody that wants to explore the cuddlers. This is what it's come to. This is what it's come to. This is doesn't speak well for the future, I'm telling you. And when we come back, I got another little extension, which hopefully won't take quite as long. But this is something else that is unbelievable that's going on in Japan, which I think is headed here shortly as well. All right, folks, this is Governor America, Vic Davis, Darren Weeks on our post-Thanksgiving show. We'll be back in a moment. We're back. This is Govern America. The website is governamerica.com. That's our official website for the broadcast. Governamerica.com, where you can get all of the shows, the various show notes, and the broadcast posted later on in the day. If you want to hear it again or happen to miss a broadcast and want to go back in time, that's governamerica.com. Also, a lot of headlines and news and stuff on the main page there, constantly updated. Continuously, and also channelingreality.com is Vicky's original research website. Channelingreality.com and thetechnocratictyranny.com is her most recent. Thetechnocratictyranny.com. My email address is radio@governamerica.com. If you'd like to get in touch, and Vicky, you want to go ahead and give yours out?
Mm-hmm. Mine is Eyes Wide Open, and there are two O's in that. Eyes Wide OOPEN. At channelingreality.com.
Yeah, and we were talking before the break about the professional cuddling phenomenon that has popped up along the landscape of the United States, and I think around the world as well. In fact, I think this started overseas, if you want to know my honest opinion, at least based upon what I've read. But it's all over the place now. It's happening in Oregon. It's happening. Really, there's a professional cuddlers popping up all over the United States. So you can go to some of these sites if you're really into that sort of thing and find a cuddler that will work for you geographically.
Well, you know what the thing is, though, that anybody can throw up a website in a couple of hours. So whether it is a real phenomenon or... We really won't know until a cuddling shop pops up in
your
neighborhood.
Near you. I liken it to prostitution without the sex.
That's right.
Because what you're really doing is hiring.
We don't know that, Darren.
What do you mean?
Goes on behind closed doors? We don't know.
Now, that's true. Now they do say that you're, you know, they strictly forbid that sexual contact happens, although you
sure.
wouldn't really know unless one of these places are raided. You wouldn't really know whether or not they follow through with that or not. It's bizarre. It's really bizarre. And another thing that's bizarre, you know, in the context of society is going nuts. You got out in Oregon, the Oregonian has a controversy going on now where there's a billboard up and people are talking about how racist this company is because they have a picture of shoes with red shoelaces. They say activists are asking why Dr. Martens chose an image that resembles a classic white supremacist skinhead symbol for a holiday billboard in inner southeast Portland. The billboard, which is visible at Southeast Madison and 7th Avenues, displays black boots with red plaid laces and a phrase, "Rock the Holidays." Now, I thought they were going to say that the S looks like a swastika, but no, that's not what it is. On Twitter, anti-hate group activist Sam Sox pointed out that that black Dr. Martens, quickly called Dr. Martens, with red laces, are a white supremacist symbol that implies that the wearer has committed an act of violence.
Really?
Yes.
Huh.
So now red shoelaces apparently symbolizes blood. According to Randy Blazek, chair of the Oregon's Coalition Against Hate Crime and a criminologist who specializes in hate groups, Dr. Martens have been connected to racist skinheads since the 1970s. Apparently it's the shoe of choice for the Nazi people, I guess. Black Dr. Martens with white shoelaces are a symbol of general white power, Blazek said over the phone Thursday. The idea, he continued, is that you graduate from white laces to red laces once you've spilled somebody's blood. Can you believe this?
I never heard that. I mean, imagine
well, now you've
that.
Heard it.
Here I am in my senior years, and I never, ever heard that from anywhere at any time.
He said, in Portland, we're tagged as Skinhead City. It's triggering. Honestly, you can't make this stuff up. Now, I wonder if we have an enemy combatant invading our shores, bombing us, are we going to have to pay attention to the shoelaces that we're having on before we run for cover? Are we going to have to, you know, before we fight, do we have to make sure our attire is politically correct? I've got a feeling that all that stuff will fall by the wayside once the real hard stuff hits.
Yeah. I think so. I'm just kind of stunned. I don't even know what to say because they can just pick out anything and say that it is a white supremacist label or symbol or something, you know, and they can do the same thing, you know, for the black community, that is a black power symbol, you know, they can just pick out anything, apparently.
Yeah. And that's what
I mean.
They
it wouldn't
seem
even
to be
occur
doing.
To me to look at somebody's shoelaces and see a message there.
Well, I think we were talking last week about the color of ice cream, or there are different ice cream flavors being racist.
Mm-hmm.
Some idea that was promoted by Ben and Jerry's, which proves again, big corporations, you know, that it's pushing an agenda. So this is obviously being pushed from on high somehow. But the thing I think that even more than the shoelaces takes the cake, and of course we can talk about professional cuddling. Professional cuddling is supposed to be, you know, anti-sex, right? It's supposed to be something that is a substitute for sexual contact. Which, what does it do? It plays into the Agenda 21 population control. Because if it's strictly, you don't, oh, no, this is professional, this is touch without sex. Well, over in Japan, this tends to be the trend where young people, in fact, The Guardian wrote an article about this. When I was researching the professional cuddling thing, I stumbled upon this. This is an article from 2013, October 20th, 2013. And it asks the question, why have young people in Japan stopped having sex? They say, what happens to a country when its young people stop having sex? Japan is finding out. Now, they say Japan's under 40s appear to be losing interest in conventional relationships. Millions are... Now, bear in mind, I'm not bemoaning... And I'm not promoting the idea of young people having unwed sex, okay? But this goes even further than just, you know, abstinence. I think abstinence is an important, and I think we've lost a lot, because we, young people, at least in the United States, are not practicing abstinence. But what we're talking about here, what I'm worried about, I guess, is the fact that they don't seem to have any real desire to even pursue a relationship. And I guess this is the theme of the whole thing, is that we're losing what it means to be a regular, normally functioning person. We're losing this interrelationship social contract that has defined humanity since the beginning of time. This chemistry that we have with each other, this ability to interact with each other and to form relationships that are healthy, this ability for us to connect, and I mean really connect, not this artificial electronic crap. So they say Japan's under 40s appear to be losing interest in conventional relationships. Millions aren't even dating, and increasing numbers can't be bothered with sex. For their government, celibacy syndrome is part of a looming national catastrophe. Japan already has one of the world's lowest birth rates. Its population is 126 million, which has been shrinking for the past decade. It's projected to plunge a further one-third by 2060. Aoyama believes the country is experiencing a flight from human intimacy, and it's partly the government's fault. The sign outside her building says clinic. She greets me in yoga pants and fluffy animal slippers, cradling a dog with whom she introduces as Marilyn Monroe. In her business pamphlet, she offers up a gloriously random confidence that she visited North Korea in the 1990s and squeezed... I won't say what, of a top army general. It doesn't say whether she was invited there specifically for that purpose, but the message to her clients, or the message, excuse me, to her clients is clear. She doesn't judge. Then she takes me inside to her relaxation room upstairs, a bedroom with no furniture except a double futon. It will be quiet in here, she says. Trying to figure out what the point of all this is. The number of single people has reached a record high. A survey in 2011 found that 61% of unmarried men and 49% of women aged 18 to 34 were not in any kind of romantic relationship, a rise of almost 10% from 5 years earlier. Another study found that a third of people under 30 had never dated at all. There are no figures for same-sex relationships, although there has been a pragmatic separation of love and sex in Japan. A country mostly free of religious morals, sex fares no better. A survey earlier this year by the Japan Family Planning Association found that 45% of women aged 16 to 24 were not interested or despised sexual contact. More than a quarter of the men felt the same way. Do you see the trend going on here? Now, this is Japan, but I'm starting to see, due to the fact that you have young people today here interested in only one thing. There's a lot of people, a lot of young people here that are losing interest in relationships here because they can't find meaningful ones.
Yeah, well, how can they find meaningful relationships? Interact with each other. If social media is destroying the ability to communicate with each other, you know, verbal, unverbal, whatever, then, yeah, it's like one big Our world seems to be one big sociological experiment.
I think so. I think so. And I think this is something that is evolving. And I'm afraid this really plays in perfectly with Agenda 21. Depopulation. Because if people can't form relationships, what it does is it's very, very... It creates the... Well, it goes right along with technocracy, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Because when you're turning society into a bunch of robots, and they're promoting at the same time, you know, sexual encounters with robots, this is crazy. Now, there's another thing going on in Japan because of a lack of real relationships. Now, they have what's called solo weddings. Solo weddings. There's a documentary that I came across on, you know, somebody posted the link in one of the comments. Love and Sex in Japan. Here's a short trailer of that, and they're talking about these weddings.
In Tokyo, the Japanese government is increasingly worried about the future of the country and its people. In the past 30 years, the number of marriages has fallen by 30%, but Naoko has nevertheless decided to tie the knot.
With the package that you've chosen, you could design a custom bouquet. You can select the flowers you want.
At just 29 years old, Naoko is thrilled at the idea of living a fairy tale. She has opted for a Western-style ceremony for her dream wedding.
I've loved planning it all. Tomorrow is a big day.
To make sure everything is perfect, Naoko is assisted by professional wedding planner Yukiko.
You're so cute. That looks amazing on you.
This is an empire-style dress. It's like something from Napoleon's time.
But although this may look like preparation for an ordinary wedding, in reality it is not quite so, as the young woman has no fiancé.
Yes, I completely forgot to look for a boyfriend.
In fact, Naoko is going to get married on her own. In Japan, they call this a solo wedding. It was Yukiko who invented solo weddings just over a year ago, and since then, she has had hundreds of clients.
At the beginning, I had a 34-year-old employee who had no plans to get married, and yet who had wanted nothing more than to wear a wedding dress since she was a little girl. She was quite upset at the idea that that was never going to happen. And one day, she confided in me that she would really like to have the opportunity to dress like a bride, and she asked me to organize that for her.
Naoko also wanted to live out her dream wedding experience, all while remaining single.
Marriage is a life choice among others. I don't know yet if I want to get married or not, or if I want to live with someone or not.
For the tidy sum of 2,400 euros, the solo wedding service lasts 24 hours. It includes a wedding dress fitting, a visit to a makeup artist, a hairstylist, a florist, and ends with a photo shoot.
Look at the camera, please.
The goal is obviously to capture this unique moment.
I'm not sad at all to not have a groom.
Are you happy?
Yes. I'm having an amazing time.
The agency was created a year ago and has already organized over 100 solo weddings. Each time, Yukiko offers the young women an actor to play the role of the groom, but all of them refuse the presence of a man.
What do you think of that?
You know what it reminds me of? When I was little, you know, like 5, 6, 7, I would play with paper dolls. I loved paper dolls. And, you know, with paper dolls, you could just get all kinds of different outfits, and you could pretend all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And it seems like they've created that kind of fantasy world for people on the for women. I don't know how many men would do that sort of thing, but a real life fantasy world on the internet, kind of a virtual reality of, you know, whatever your fantasy is.
Yeah.
That's really bizarre.
Yeah, it's bizarre. It's narcissistic as heck. I mean, and then I think that's really what we're probably the biggest thing about social media that I despise the most is the narcissism that it promotes.
The thing is, though, I did that when I was a little kid. And that's when you're developing your imagination. These people are doing this as adults, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah, young adults.
They're living in a fantasy world as adults. That is scary.
Well, and the thing is, they don't like their present reality. So now it's like you can create whatever reality you want. I mean, if you don't like being a boy, you can be a girl. You can be 60 something genders in between. Talk about thinking outside the box. I mean, you can be whatever you want to be. It's like the old army slogan. Whatever reality you want to create, you can create it and make it real just by declaring it.
Well, you know, the magnitude of that kind of delusion just it never occurred to me before. I never really, because I don't spend a lot of time doing that sort of thing. But I think that's huge. I wonder how many psychologists and psychiatrists are working on this or even looking at it.
I'm not kidding you, Vicky. When I was, I don't know, I think it might have been Thursday night. I don't know if it's the days run together, but as I discovered this and I started reading more and more about this stuff, I found myself getting profoundly depressed because I see the damage that all of this technology is having on society. I see the damage of social media mainly on society. And this really is going to play into some of the other congressional hearings and think tank stuff that we'll get into later on in the broadcast. I know I spent a little more time on this than I intended to, but I think it's important.
I try to pay attention to a lot of what goes on the internet, but I had no idea about what you're talking about with this, but it's very frightening to me.
Yeah, because you wonder how society is going to be in 10 years. You wonder how things are going to be maybe in 20 years. I mean, down the road, what are things going to look like when people don't even know what it means to be a person? They don't know what it means to be a human being. They don't know how to form relationships. They're antisocial. You know, I got two daughters that I started off in the, homeschooling. I homeschooled both of my daughters for the first 4 years of their education. Right around 2004, my mother passed away at the same time. My wife's mother had a stroke. It was one of the darkest periods of my life, and we were all tied up at the time dealing with family matters, and my children then were falling up behind, and I very reluctantly finally enrolled them in the public school system because we had to do something. But people talk and have talked for years about how the biggest challenge with homeschooling is properly socializing them, properly getting them out of the house, having them have contact with other children so they know how to form relationships. Now today, instead of it being homeschooled children having this challenge, and I will call it a challenge because it can be overcome. If you make an effort to do it, you can easily socialize them, take them to the park. I would say supervise them because there's a lot of perverts that hang out at the park. But you can overcome these challenges. But what we're dealing with now today is a society of adults that spend their time isolated, that spend their time in their bedrooms, in their living rooms, in their houses, communicating online, texting people constantly, constantly looking through their phones. They're walking out into traffic, getting hit by cars because they can't take their eyes off the stinking phone. And as a result, society is paying a huge cost. This is not a small problem. This is a massive sociological issue that I think is only going to get worse.
I'm not. I don't even know if the larger society is even aware of this.
No.
I don't think they are.
They're aware of the symptoms.
Everybody knows that cell phones and cars are a problem, but this is at a deeper level that is really not, I don't think that the larger society would be aware of, because people that are engaged in technology, they really are in a world of their own. I'm in a world of my own.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I kind of... you could say that I have that same pathology. I don't really interact with people, and I stay by myself in my house. But
I'm introverted. There's a difference between being introverted and being antisocial. There is a difference between introversion or, you know, seclusion and not knowing how to relate with people because you have an artificial contact with people.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I'll go along with that. My exile is self-imposed, and it's really because I do have a hard time relating with most of the world because I don't have anything I can talk to them about.
Yeah.
I'm so deep in my world that I can't talk to them about it, and I'm not interested in their world.
Well, there are a lot of mixed up people in the world, and I don't know. I don't want to depress people out there. Maybe have to talk somebody off the ledge or anything, but I think this is something people need to be. It needs to be brought to everyone's attention, and I don't know what we do about it, other than raise awareness. There's going to be support groups in the future for this. I guarantee it.
Oh, I believe it. Yeah.
All right, we're at the top of the hour already. Stay with us, folks. Governed America continues in hour two in just a moment.
Crisis of our republic, waging war on the new world order. This is Govern America. Govern America.
We're just south of the Great Lakes capital city, covering all of North America via satellite, micro FM stations all across the country, and streaming live from FEMA Region 5. This is the second hour of Govern America. Darren Weeks and Vicki Davis here with you, as we are every Saturday. It continues to be the 25th of November, 2017, as we get right back into it. I think the next place I want to go here is this net neutrality debate. Now, I know you and I, Vicki, we've differed in the past, and I don't know if we still do on this subject. I really haven't changed my opinion on the matter. And as a matter of fact, I really think it's more of... I'm really more... grounded in the subject of net neutrality. I look at everything. It looks like everybody is losing their crap over this FCC decision to undo the Obama era net neutrality thing. Were you going to say something?
No.
What's that?
I'm not 100% sure that they didn't change the definition of net neutrality, Net neutrality was always the reverse of what you would think it was.
Yes.
But I think they reversed it. And so I'm not sure exactly what is being talked about today as net neutrality.
Well, one thing I know is that the leftist, you know, all these left-wing people are all in on net neutrality. George Soros has spent a lot of money, millions of dollars, supporting net neutrality groups. What net neutrality is really about, in my opinion, is nothing more than peerage. It's about peerage. You have, let's say you have Vicky's Internet group. Okay, let's say you're an ISP. You have, you know, Vicky's Internet Incorporated. And you have quite a substantial user base. And along comes Google. Now, everything's going along fine until one day, you know, along comes Google with their paid video services. Some of them paid. I mean, either way, they're making money off of your customers. You're charging a flat rate. You're charging your subscribers so much a month. And Google comes along, or whatever big company, fill in the blank, and all of a sudden, your subscribers are going there for content, which is fine, except for one thing. This is bandwidth-intensive, monstrous bandwidth-intensive stuff, and it's clogging your network. It's to the point where, I mean, Google doesn't care because they're making tons of money and they have huge fiber lines. They got a lot of capacity to deal with it. But you, as a smaller company, but still with a large subscription base, you're faced with the problem of other customers being disenfranchised because you now, during peak hours, they can't get to websites, they can't do their banking, they can't do whatever it is they do online. And so you're looking at the possibility, really the need, of having to upgrade your routers, your switches, your bandwidth, you know, fiber optic lines and whatever, at your own expense. So you go to, you know, you go to, so what? How are you going to pay for it? Well, you know, you can charge more, but people will be upset about that because they don't want to pay more, and already they're upset and they start complaining because, hey, I can't do what I want to do online. I'm getting reduced speeds. So you go to Google, or, you know, in this case, we're going to use that as an example. Hey, you're making money off of, you're serving ads, YouTube's got a subscription-based service now, YouTube Red is what it's called. But it could be Netflix, it could be Amazon, it could be anything. But you go to that company and you say, hey, I need money, I need compensation. You're making a ton of money. If you don't give me compensation, I'm going to be forced to drop some packets here. So maybe my subscribers won't get a high-definition video from you. Maybe they'll get, you know, a pixelated video, or at least a lesser quality thing. Or maybe there might even be some buffering. But I've got to do it in order to keep from disenfranchising the rest of my customers. Net neutrality would put an end to that. Net neutrality would force companies, as I understand it, to treat every packet equally. Google wants net neutrality. The big companies like them want net neutrality because what it does is it provides them special access. It provides them the ability to shove massive amounts of bandwidth into other companies' networks and not have to worry about them slowing it down or managing their network properly. That's what net neutrality is.
Okay. Well, you know what? We have an interest base that all has different interests. Mm-hmm. Now, when I was looking at net neutrality, the idea was that some companies that wanted to use a lot of bandwidth would be able to charge their customers for a fast lane, in effect.
Yeah, that's a media term. The media came up with a fast lane thing. And when you think go ahead.
But it makes sense to me that they would do that. But what that would do is that since I already pay $60 a month for my internet connection, if they want me to pay more, so that I can get these movies and YouTube and everything else. I can't pay anymore.
Yeah.
And the same thing is happening with all these paywalls, you know, that they're putting up. I understand why they're doing it, but, you know, I can't, you know, subscribe, you know, $10 a month for everything I want to look at.
Right.
So they'll be, by doing that, they will be pricing me out of the market, you know, to where I might as well not even have a connection.
But I would say from my studying of this issue, that the exact opposite is true from what you just described. Instead of the fast access, you know, oh, they're going to charge for a fast lane. What Google wants, and keep in mind, this was something Obama did, and Google is very close, was very close to the Obama administration. They were like two peas in a pod. And I'm sure that there was a lot of lobbying going on from Google to the Obama administration to get them to do this. And so, but this provides them special access. This would provide Google the fast lane, and they don't have to pay to get it.
Well, wait a second, though. That's not the whole story there, because my own cable company has service levels based on speed.
Yeah,
so that's a part of my cable company is selling a fast lane.
Yeah, but
and what I'm saying is that I can't afford to get that. I think the middle tier, which is unlimited at a certain speed. It's certainly not the fastest speed, but you know.
I look at it. It's not a problem.
It will be a problem though if once they implement that.
What they're doing is they're passing out down the cost again. Using my my example here, they're passing down the cost to the customer for usage. They're passing down the cost of upgrading and managing their network. I mean, the more traffic coming in, the more it is it's taking its toll on the network. And so the argument could be made somebody's going to pay for it. And I look at it, we hear a lot about congestion, we hear a lot about clogging things, and we hear a lot of nightmare scenarios if we don't have this net neutrality. Problem is, I see the very thing if they do have it, because network owners have got to be able to manage their networks. They've got to be. If something is causing things, congestion on their network, they've got to be able to slow it down, to drop the packets, to properly deal with the problem. Otherwise, you literally are going to not be able to, it's going to break the internet. If network managers can't manage.
Yeah, so we have at least three interest groups.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've got the whales like Google.
Yeah.
And then we've got the small internet providers. And then we have customers. And they all three have their different tales of woe. So who wins in that? You know, if Google wins, then or if your small internet providers win and can charge more, then I lose, and so I'm out.
I don't think so. Keep in mind, we've had a world without net neutrality all this time, and we've been fine.
No, that's not so. Actually, that's not so. We have always had net neutrality. The cable providers are the ones that wanted to change that so that they could have different tiers of pricing for different speeds.
Well, some of this is a relatively new phenomenon because of the advent of video services. You know, it's only been, again, a relatively new phenomenon for people to watch whole movies on the internet. and yeah. it's being marketed as a as an idea, as something that people should just do. And comes back to, again, I mean, and then there are some things that the FCC is doing that I don't approve of, big time. Like, for instance, they just ended the main studio rule for TV and radio broadcasters. I think that's going to be disastrous because it's going to promote more of the same corporate consolidation that we've seen. You can have one company streaming out their, you know, using the internet, again, as their STL, their studio transmitter link, rather than having a local facility, and they can just stream it to their transmitter site from some state, some other state in the union. They don't even have to worry about maintaining the real estate to have a place for people to come and do public access broadcasts and things like that.
Ah, interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
It's more corporatism as I view it.
Mm-hmm.
I could see how it would help some small-time broadcasters. But anyway.
Yeah, well, this debate started, I remember, back in 2004, 2005, when the idea of net neutrality first came up. And what the cable companies wanted to be able to do was to basically wall off their customer base, you know, create gardens of content, you know, rather than the wild west of the internet, you know, where you could go where you wanted to go. And so it's really a serious problem. I know that it's been talked about that the internet, because it's a networked system where everybody shares the communications lines between servers, it really is kind of a public utility. Mm-hmm. And I think probably it needs, maybe if it needs to be regulated, it should be regulated as a public utility.
Well,
because otherwise the whales out there, you know, the Facebook and Google and Netflix and all of the other big websites, they will just chew up all the bandwidth.
Yeah, and they are, and that's what this,
and
that's
knock what, everybody else off.
That's what they want to do, and I look at, you know, George Soros spending millions of dollars, him being on the side of this so-called net neutrality, and it's a great term. I mean, it's perfect. I mean, if you want to get people on board with something, that's a great term, net neutrality. I wonder who thought of that.
Well, I don't know, but I when
you cut out.
I really had to study and try and figure out what they were talking about, mm-hmm. because the term itself doesn't tell you anything.
No, it's deceptive.
Yeah, and so, but I'm not. But here again, I'm not sure that they didn't change the definition from the first time that I actually was studying the issue years ago.
Yeah, Ron sent me a clip, and this is really, I think, pretty much typical of the media coverage on this subject.
Well, Communications Commission has released a plan to dismantle regulations that ensure equal access to the internet. It will affect all of you who have the internet at home. Fox News reporter Peter Ducey explains how.
It's called net neutrality, an Obama-era regulation put in place to ensure equal access to the internet. Now the FCC is poised to do away with those rules, drastically increasing the power of internet service providers, or ISPs, to regulate what you can access online.
Okay, now this is,
that's the walled garden of content.
This is so typical because they're only telling one side of the story. Okay, they don't tell both sides. And as far as guaranteeing equal access, I would argue with that point. Now, you were talking about how they are able to charge you different rates for different speeds. Well, none of these speeds are guaranteed, first of all. They can charge you a top dollar speed, and I can tell you more than likely the speed they're telling you you're getting you're not getting. So
right.
That's a
yes,
scam in and of itself. But the second, the real issue here, in my opinion, is not whether they charge for different rates for different speeds. It's the fact that still in the 21st century, after, 20 years of the Internet? Let's see, the Internet came along sometime in the 90s, as we know it anyway. At least we started hearing about it in earnest. We're about 30 years. Anyway, the point is very short period of time, but in terms of the Internet and the speed at which things move today, it's an eternity. And yet we still have monopolistic type of Internet companies. You still have.
It will continue to be because that's the nature of computer systems. They will continue to combine for greater power, greater efficiency, to increase their bottom line. They will continue to merge and create bigger and bigger companies. That's the nature of computer systems.
Yeah, and this is the biggest issue we have, because let's say, for instance, if you had choices, if you had more than one choice where you live for internet, it wouldn't matter if companies charge you more or less. If you didn't like what they were doing, you could go to somebody else. That's the market. That's the free market at work. But we don't have a free market when you only have one company that you can buy it or not buy it from. And that's the issue. For years, it wasn't until 2012 that we got fiber out here, and it was only because of a fluke. It was because the company that was in business, our phone company, wanted to sell the accounts. They wanted to get out of the business out here because I think it was Verizon at the time, and they were selling all the lines out here. And Frontier was buying them up. And Frontier made it a condition of sale that what you're selling us, what we're buying from you, is a dying business model. People are going to cell phones. So the only way we're able to continue and make this a profitable deal for us is if you run fiber so that we can offer DSL service in the countryside. And so Verizon spent, I'm sure, a gob and a bunch of money in order to lay fiber out here so that we can, do this radio show. I mean, obviously, that's not why they did it, but that's the side effect of it. Frontier wouldn't buy it unless they laid the fiber. So that's the only reason it's still not anywhere close to what you'd get in a city, but it's adequate. And sometimes during peak hours, it's not even that. But it's a monopolistic problem. And as far as big corporations are concerned, the big elephant in the room that nobody seems to be talking about is if Google really is clogging networks, and if companies like Netflix, if this is a big problem where it's monopolistic, why aren't they talking about breaking up these big companies?
Well, hang on a sec. Okay. Speaking about monopolies, there are some businesses that are really natural. Company, for example. Now, what they did with the power companies is to create an artificial market.
Mm-hmm.
They separated the transmission lines to make, they created a separate line of business called transmission for electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And they have created an artificial market for distribution so that electricity customers can choose from company A, company B, or company C, but the product is the same. And there is a very high cost to the facilities of distribution of electricity. You've got the lines, the poles, all of that, and the same with the distribution system behind it. It's a very high in terms of the infrastructure that you need to deliver electricity to the home.
Mm-hmm.
So creating an artificial market just increases the costs. That's, which is kind of what you're saying that they need to do with the cable company, because the problem is exactly the same.
Well, this is going to be a debate that goes on for a long time. And more than likely, I mean, they're going to knock it down here shortly, but the next administration that comes in might very well be a Democrat administration, and they'll resurrect it again. And I just find it very interesting that all of the people that are on the wrong side of everything else are all in with net neutrality, as it's being defined here.
FCC Chairman Ajit Pai claims the change is necessary because, he says, the current rules constrain online investment and prevent companies from innovating.
We want all kinds of companies, not the startups of the future, to be able to invest and innovate on the web. And the best way to do that is to ensure that everybody has the freedom to pursue a business plan that will serve the consumers well.
But critics say that's not true. They claim Pai, a former lawyer for Verizon, is engineering a big giveaway to the telecom industry, allowing companies like AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast to decide what websites and online services customers can see and use and charge what they want for those services.
I think it's tragic for American consumers, and it's shameful for an agency that's supposed to be protecting consumers.
The plan is supported by the White House, but opposed by most congressional Democrats and companies like Netflix, Amazon, and other content providers, who say they may have to pay to keep those streams flowing at super speed, and that could drive up costs for customers.
And that's exactly the issue I was talking about.
Across the board.
Google, Facebook, you know, they fear that, you know, AT&T is going to start charging them to use their lines.
The FCC is scheduled to vote on the plan December 14th, and it's expected to pass.
Okay. Well, that's enough of that. Anyway, I think...
Well, but that is the walled gardens of content, and I object to that because they will be, just like my cable TV now, they choose which channels I can see. On the internet now, I can go anywhere. When I do a search, goes out, and I can, you know, read some obscure little blog that under the new plan, I won't be able to get, because that will not be in the package of websites that they will offer to me.
Mm-hmm.
So, when it gets to be that way, they will be able to shape your world as you see it.
Well, we'll see what happens.
That includes the political websites, too.
Either way, regardless of what side you're on this thing, I think it's very apparent that there are a lot of competing interests involved. And I think there's, you know, he mentioned Ajit Pai being a former Verizon, affiliate, for lack of a better way of saying it. But I can distinctly remember Commissioner Wheeler, Chairman Wheeler of the FCC, who was the chairman during the Obama administration. He was a cable guy. So all of these people are industry lobbyists that are filling these administrative roles, these bureaucratic roles. So I think this is going to go back and forth like a ping pong ball, from administration to administration, which is ultimately going to cost more money industry wide, because you're going to continually have the rules of the game changed, given the whims of a certain administration. It's really remarkable.
Well, maybe the thing to do is to break up companies like Amazon and Google. Maybe that's the solution, and limit the amount of bandwidth that they're able to take.
Yes, that's exactly what I was saying earlier. And that's the thing that none of these people, and of course they don't want that talked about.
No, of course not.
You know, I'm not beyond too. I think that some of these corporations should have their corporate charters pulled, especially when they do damage to society. I mean, you've got companies like Equifax out there that have been able to cause so much damage to society with their complete inattention to the details of security when you're dealing with people's most personal information. Information, we're not customers of Equifax. This is their business model to have our information, and yet they take it, and they're very haphazard, very flippant with the security involved. And increasingly,
well, and we're going to have an issue here with health information, too. That would be a really interesting book if somebody would put it together and just look company by company and sector by sector of the damage that the Internet has caused.
Yeah.
Their use of the Internet and what it has done to the society and to business. And everything, you know, just a full analysis.
Yeah, I think that these corporate leaders should be held criminally responsible if they don't secure people's information properly. And right now, I don't see any of that. With Equifax, they're actually running an ad now saying, hey, has your information leaked online? Hey,
well,
subscribe
they
here.
They've monetized.
Yeah, they've monetized their own security breach. It's outrageous. It's outrageous. I was incensed when I saw this. Hang on, we got to take the bottom of the hour break. We'll be back. Welcome back to the broadcast. This is Govern America. GovernAmerica.com is where you find us on the internet. GovernAmerica.com and TheTechnocraticTyranny.com and ChannelingReality.com. Those are the websites. I think we've exhausted the net neutrality thing. You know, one thing I would like to say regarding the subject of corporate charters. I think these major corporations, when they prove to be detrimental to society, need to have their corporate charters removed. And I was talking about Equifax before the break there. I think that's a perfect example because they're damaging society. And these big corporations, Vicki, this is a constant topic of this broadcast, as you know, corporatism and the detrimental effect of these massive corporations on society. It should be for the good. Of society that these things are allowed to exist. But as they get bigger and bigger and they gain more power for themselves, they cease to be private enterprise. They take on a insane role. I mean, it's like they've gone crazy and they're treated like a person. It's corporate personhood.
Mm-hmm. I found an article on my website that somebody sent to me that back in 1972, they were already talking about corporations that were multinational, that were could no longer be considered really American corporations.
Mm-hmm.
And the way our political system works, free speech and all of that, they have given corporations basically the right, same rights as people, as human beings.
Yeah.
And so we have these gigantic, giant corporate, quote, citizens.
Corporate citizens?
Congress. Yeah, lobbying our Congress for legislation that is in their interest, that is absolutely contrary to the interests of people.
Yeah.
And citizens, and you know,
and they have the money.
They have the money to buy our Congress, and they basically have bought our Congress.
Our Congress, our bureaucratic agencies, you mm-hmm. name it. I mean, it's a revolving door. The FDA, the pharmaceutical company, perfect example of that. You know, as we, you know, during that break, we had the fluoride thing. That was one of many things, but we got vaccinations, And again, I come back to the documentary Vaxxed. If anybody needs to have a reference point, watch that. I mean,
right? It's a revolving door between corporate sectors, the lobbyists in Washington, D.C., and the sectors of the economy in and out of government. And I do think that our political situation today, that we're in the disaster that we are in with globalization and everything else, is as a result of that.
Yeah, and when you could talk about the military-industrial complex, you know, and how all in the United States government is with that. I mean, you've got diplomatic trips based solely upon selling weapons.
Well, and don't forget, they've folded in the tech industry into the military-industrial complex.
There you go.
So
the tech industry, security issues, security, airport security is now a part of this.
Most definitely. Well, the tech industry is into everything because they are implementing technology to control every aspect of our lives.
Yeah.
Absolutely everything.
Yeah, speaking of psychopathic corporations, this is Uber is one of those ones I think, in my opinion, should have their corporate charter pulled.
We are learning more about the Uber cyber attack that we first told you about last night. Millions of Uber customers now checking their personal information after the company revealed it was the target of a massive hack attack last year, impacting some 57 million customers. The hackers had access to customers' names, email addresses, and phone numbers, as well as the names and addresses of drivers. Uber also admitted it paid $100,000 ransom to keep the information from going public.
It's disappointing. Yeah, I'm all about transparency, so that's unfortunate. I wish there was more of a safer way to get around, but I mean, it's convenient because it's, you know, fast to get places.
The company's CEO says the two employees responsible for the payout have been fired, and he's taking full responsibility for cybersecurity moving forward. Officials in the UK have already said the breach raises major concerns about the company's future in Europe. The Missouri Attorney General is also investigating Uber's action.
Okay, I don't know what that was at the end. Yeah, so
the thing is that They really can't.
Do you got your mic off?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did. Sorry. I was going to say. The thing is that they really can't secure the systems if they are on the open telecommunications network. Mm-hmm. Because any security that anybody designs, and I don't care who it is, there is somebody out there. There somewhere that can hack it, that will figure out how to hack it.
Yeah.
So
I maintain these people should be held responsible. Why put all of your customers' data online? And credit card information is one thing. But when you're dealing with stuff that can't be changed, I mean, Social Security numbers, and now where they're wanting to take it is biometric information. I mean, and the advent of putting biometric information, using that as an identifier, using that as a payment system, I think that's the most alarming thing to me that you could do. Because given the fact that you have all of this, these security breaches going on everywhere, And they're only getting more common. And I think they're only going to get more common. Because there's a huge payoff for anybody who's a criminal or a state actor that's trying to compromise these systems. But cybercrime is a really big problem. So why put, you know, and then we can talk about the healthcare industry and all of these documents floating around. Somebody sent me Massachusetts, sent me a piece on dealing with the subject of, let me see if I can find it here. This is really alarming what they're doing here. Anita Hoag wrote an article on newswithviews.com, and I just had time to scan it. I didn't really have time to do a deep dive reading it, but just to base upon my cursory read of it, she says, "Stop the government-controlled minority report, which will be used as the new census. Can the motherload of federal data hurt you? The new planned economy and how you can put a wrench in their gear." Oh, okay. I'm guessing those are. Anyway, it says, "Our children are seized in captive environments, awash with mental health synonyms, and cleansed with proper psychological interventions, preparing them for a global tomorrow. Human capital is the phrase. What is your child's worth or worthlessness to the economy?" Now, I remember, just as an aside note here, Joan Vian always talking about the family dependency ratio.
Yep.
Here we are. Seeing this materialize in society.
Mm-hmm.
Data and psychological...
It'll be discrimination through technology. And mm-hmm. But the thing is that they record assessments. So I don't know how you were when you were in elementary school, but if you did something bad, you know, it might have gotten written in your record, but it got buried over time. It wasn't held against you.
Yeah.
But with computerized records, that history will follow you your whole life.
Yeah, and that's exactly what she's talking about here. Mm-hmm. Data and psychological profiles decide their future. Parents and their intergenerational impact are a target for proper child rearing and engagement to accept and match the federal standards. Beware. Yes, it was your government that allowed this to happen, but parents have not observed the changes, nor do they care. No rebellion is happening. They do not think that data collection is going to hurt their child until, in Inner Data Mining 101, the truth about H.R. 4174. The original graph, and she publishes a graph here, taken from the Federal Cooperative Accountability Project, 1974, outlined societal outputs monitoring all aspects of inputs in life, womb to tomb. All outputs can be categorized, cross-referenced, and financially detailed to determine what the future global citizen will be like. The worth of a person identified with a unique national ID can be calculated by creating an algorithm subtracting all investments and consumption through feedbacks made to evaluate the value of the end product. The key to this process is evidence-based, which codes every action taken to control the end product. What is the objective? Monitoring the process of human capital to get the defined end product. How will the end product be controlled? Cooperative accountability. That's the science in H.R. 4174, the legislation, to create a one massive government database that can hook into any data it wants to determine what you can or cannot do. Your future hangs in the balance, she says.
Yeah, she explained that really well. I'm impressed. I saw the article, but I didn't read it. But she's exactly right. And the thing is that, do you want teachers to be able to do psychological evaluations?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so. But that's the way this thing is going.
Yeah.
And they will keep those records, and they will evaluate your child, and they will be steered towards a career path based on grades and the evaluations and everything else. Probably the social factors. You know, if a child is determined to be disadvantaged for some reason, you know, they may give them a boost. And while your child has no disadvantages, except perhaps maybe extraordinarily high intelligence level, mm-hmm. in the future world, you know, they will direct that child towards a career waiting table or something.
Yeah.
You know, because the schools for years have been on this egalitarian bent, determined to show that the differences in children is simply a matter of how they are being raised.
Absolutely. And this is the planned society. This is the planned economy.
Mm-hmm.
Profiling school children based upon their personality types and their performances in society, databasing it all. I mean, this is school to work, but which is a part of the planned society. It's communistic in nature.
Totally. When I first started looking at systems, it was the systems that I saw that they were setting up in schools that really made me start looking at government systems, because the system that I saw that they planned on developing, the National Human Resource Management System, mm-hmm. Listen to that, National
yeah.
Human Resource Management System, it's totally un-American.
Yeah, I don't like being called a resource anyway.
Yeah, or human capital.
Yeah, human capital. That makes you a number. What are you worth? What can you give to society? And after you're done, please wither up and die. Because,
right.
Hey,
when you've
we don't want to support
you. Your useful life, just go away and die.
Yes. Exactly.
And I think ultimately they will help you die.
Yes, I think you're right. And then, you know, Dr. Lawrence Dunnigan, recalling the population control guy, Dr. Richard Day, what he gave in his speech before those groups of pediatric physician students back in 1961 in the New Order of the Barbarians is what it was called. He referenced that, the demise pill. Mm-hmm.
Yep, you're all done.
St. Louis County, Missouri, you're on the air.
Well, this is Sam, actually.
Oh, okay.
Calling in.
How you doing?
But fine. We're showing up probably because I'm calling you through our studio line, and that's the closest number we could get, so that's what's confusing you. Welcome to the new slavery, guys.
Yeah, really. I don't think it feels very good.
I mean, what a disaster. I mean, and of course, Trish and I've been warning people about this human resources terminology for a long time. You know, I mean, I can remember when you went to apply for a job, you went to the personnel office,
mm-hmm.
which is where you went. That's what it was called. And now they don't call it that anymore. They call it Department of Human Resources. Well, words mean things, and I keep telling people that all the time, and this kind of, I think, underscores exactly what that all means. But they have to push it incrementally. And so this is what I see on that. But I wanted to harken back to this issue you were talking about with Equifax a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
What you have here is a setup just to be able to charge more money for services that should be just automatic. If you want this much protection, pay this. If you want this much protection, pay that. Just another way with these companies faltering on their with these breaches, just another way for these other companies to pop up and offer you all this protection, but for a fee, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And so what ultimately winds up happening is there's no absolute guarantee, even if you pay out all this extra money, that you're going to have protection, because when are these companies going to eventually come along and go, uh-oh, we had a breach too, and now your data is exposed because of a breach in our system.
Yeah, there's a monetary incentive. When they're allowed to have a monetary incentive to charge you more money or to offer a service to deal with the very thing that was caused by their lack of prudence or what's the word I'm looking for here? Their lack of being forward thinking and I'm blanking on the word I'm looking for here. But their lack of attention to detail with regard to security. I mean, seeing some of the practices of the company were just absolutely deplorable. And I think it's criminal the way they handled it. And now you got more and more of these companies that are doing the very same thing. That not only, go ahead.
Yeah, it's the same scam we were fed with the IRS for years, you know, and then now we have companies all popping up to help you reduce your IRS debt and all this stuff for a fee, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But now we're just going to take it one step further with all the credit agencies and do similar to the same thing, you see.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what they can do nowadays? They can have holding companies where they have one company that is one side of the business, like Equifax, keeping your credit records. But they can also own the company where you pay insurance, you know. to protect your credit record, which is what you were saying, Darren. But they can actually be owned by the same owner.
It's kind of like the banks. They're being able to be investment banks while at the same time being able to be commercial banks.
Exactly. And there,
it's a conflict of interest.
We used to have laws that prevented that.
Mm-hmm.
Now banks apparently can be investors in their customers. When a customer goes to the bank for a loan, the bank itself can become an investor in whatever it is you're getting the loan for.
Yep.
That used to be against the law.
It's the same scheme we had, just like I say, just an extension of the same scheme with the IRS, because how many times do you hear an ad regarding, our former IRS agents can help you, you know, reduce your debt, and of course the operative part of this is former IRS agents. So where'd they come from? They came from the very agency. So it's not in the vested interest to get rid of the income tax because there's too much money made off of it. So can we move this forward and say it's not in their vested interest to get rid of the breaching of security, you know, our people, the breaching of people's data, because after all, there's too much money being made off of it.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. That's the problem. Right there is precisely it. If you don't,
it's the same stupid scam sold to us under different umbrellas, but in the end, it all comes out to be the same. It's all making, in the end, making money off of you under the guise of protecting you.
What we've said here over and over and over again is public policy 101. That which you encourage more of, you get more of. That which you discourage, you get less of. So through the policies that you put into place, if you provide a monetary incentive for people to be haphazard with their security because they can make more money off of it, why wouldn't you have more breaches? There's no consequences.
Right, which is the fallacy of corporations having rights, because when people commit criminal acts, they can get the death penalty, mm-hmm. but nothing happens with a corporation. They just might pay a fine, but it's always a very small fine.
Yep.
And you can bet there are kickbacks on that, you know, the small fine and, you know, fill up my bank account in Luxembourg, thank you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks,
all right,
Sam.
Guys, that's all I got. But,
all right.
Just thought I'd weigh in on that.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you. I hope you had a good Thanksgiving. All right. Blessings. There he is, Sam in Missouri. Speaking of the swamp, for lack of a better way of saying it, we had Jeff Sessions testifying on Capitol Hill a week ago, or maybe it's a week and a half. Maybe it might have been 2 weeks ago now. I don't know. Time flies, whether or not you're having fun, as Derry Brownfield used to say. And the subject was this situation regarding whether or not there was enough evidence to prosecute the Clintons. You know, this is one thing that the administration was promoting big time during the campaign, that they were going to pursue Hillary Clinton. As soon as Trump went from being candidate Trump to being president-elect Trump, then immediately the story changed. And it was, oh, I don't want to hurt them. Well, now you got Sessions on Capitol Hill, and they're asking him all these questions about whether or not, you know, Trey Gowdy is up there and other people as well, and you know, whether or not there's enough evidence. Why aren't we prosecuting Hillary Clinton, the Clinton Foundation, you know, Bill Clinton, all these scumbags who have been taking bribes from foreign governments, and this in the Uranium One deal, where 20%, you know, talk about Russia collusion, Russia ended up with 20% of the United States uranium. And at the same time, while they're paying them for speeches and all this sort of thing, you know, so this is some of what happened during the hearing.
Mr. Attorney General, I appreciate your service in the Senate. I appreciate your service at the Justice Department. Consider you a friend. And frankly, I appreciate yesterday's letter saying you were considering appointing a special counsel that you sent to us. But my concern is we sent you a letter 3.5 months ago asking for a second special counsel. And if you're now just considering it, what's it going to take to get a special counsel? We know that former FBI Director James Comey misled the American people in the summer of 2016 when he called the Clinton investigation a matter. It's obviously an investigation. We know FBI Director Comey was drafting an exoneration letter before the investigation was complete. We know Loretta Lynch, one day before the Benghazi report came out, 5 days before Secretary Clinton was scheduled to be interviewed by the FBI, met with former President Bill Clinton on a tarmac in Phoenix. We know after that meeting, when she was corresponding with public relations people at the Justice Department, she was using the name Elizabeth Carlisle. You know, as I've said before, it seems to me if you're just talking golf and grandkids, you can probably use your real name. We know that Mr. Comey publicized the investigation, and we know he made the final decision on whether to prosecute or not. And then when he gets fired, he leaks a government document through a friend to the New York Times, and what was his goal? To create momentum for a special counsel, and of course it can't just be any special counsel, it's got to be Bob Mueller, his best friend, his predecessor, his mentor. The same Bob Mueller who was involved, we've now learned, in this whole investigation with the informant regarding Russian businesses wanting to do business in the uranium business here in the United States regarding the Uranium One deal. So I guess my main question is, what's it going to take, if all that, not to mention the dossier information, what's it going to take to actually get a special counsel?
It will take a factual basis that meets the standards of the appointment of a special counsel.
And is that analysis going on right now?
Well, it's in the manual of the Department of Justice about what's required. We've only had two. The first one was the Waco, Janet Reno, Senator Danforth, who took over that investigation as special counsel, and Mr. Mueller. Each of those are pretty special factual situations.
Let me ask it this way.
And we will use the proper standards, and that's what only thing I can tell you, Mr. Jordan.
Well, I appreciate that.
You can
that.
Have your idea, but sometime we have to study what the facts are and to evaluate whether it meets the standard.
Well said. So let me ask you this. If, in fact,
a special counsel.
Well, we know one fact. We know the Clinton campaign, the Democrat National Committee paid for, through the law firm, paid for the dossier. We know that happened. And it sure looks like the FBI was paying the author of that document, and it sure looks like a major political party was working with the federal government to then turn an opposition research document, the equivalent of some National Enquirer story, into an intelligence document, take that to the FISA court so that they could then get a warrant to spy on Americans associated with President Trump's campaign. That's what it looks like. And I'm asking you, doesn't that warrant, in addition to all the things we know about James Comey in 2016, doesn't that warrant naming a second special counsel, as 20 members of this committee wrote you 3.5 months ago asking you to do?
Okay, hold on. I got to take the break. When I come back, I will reveal to the audience where the scam is here, because there is a scam involved in this. Stay with us. We'll be back.
The crisis of our republic, waging war on the new world order. This is Govern America. Govern America.
From just south of the Great Lakes capital city, covering all of North America via satellite, micro FM stations all across the country, and streaming live from FEMA Region 5 and Michigan Planning Region 2. This is the third and final hour of Govern America. It continues to be the 25th of November 2017 here as we have our post-Thanksgiving show. Hopefully everybody's belly is out there full of turkey. Hopefully you're not being a turkey. But we got plenty of turkeys in government, plenty of turkeys in the private industry that we have to deal with on a regular basis. One of those is Jeff Sessions. But it's not only Jeff Sessions, it's the people that are involved in Congress, because technically Jeff Sessions here is telling the truth. We're talking about whether or not the special counsel should be appointed to investigate the Clintons and all of their dealings. And I find it interesting that the only question that's being asked is about the special counsel.
Naming a second special counsel, as 20 members of this committee wrote you 3.5 months ago asking you to do.
Well, Mr. Comey is no longer the director of the FBI.
Thank goodness.
We have an excellent man of integrity and ability in Chris Wray, and I think he's going to do an outstanding job, and I'm very happy about
that. He's not here today,
that.
Attorney General.
And I would say,
I'm asking for a special counsel.
The time of the gentleman
I would
expired.
Say looks like is not enough basis to appoint a special counsel.
Okay, here's the scam. The scam is, as he explained to them, there are certain criteria that have to be met to meet a special counsel. All the focus is on whether Sessions will appoint a special counsel. But there's no need for a special counsel here. As Sessions pointed out, the criteria is very specific for a special counsel. And he goes on to explain what that criteria is. It involves a conflict of interest. If there is something at the Justice Department which causes all of the Justice Department attorneys to not be able to look into something fairly, then a special counsel is needed if there's a conflict of interest. But the Justice Department can investigate anybody it wants. And that is really the key here. None of these Congress critters are asking Jeff Sessions, why doesn't he go after the Clintons? Or you know, we're not asking him, are you investigating the Clintons? Are you investigating their crimes? Are you seeking to prosecute what they've done? No, no, no. All the focus is on the special counsel, which doesn't apply here. That's the scam. There's no reason they can't go after the Clintons. Go ahead.
I have been looking at that, too. I've been looking at the Department of Justice. And because of the videos, I watched Jeff Sessions give a speech to the Federalist Society. And he gave a few hints in there, but you had to know what he was talking about to pick up on him. Mm-hmm. But our Department of Justice has been bifurcated. There is an international divisions within
what?
Within the Department of Justice.
Okay.
And those came into being in the as a NED program for global governance, you know, building the international law system for global governance. And the thought occurred to me that they may have used this whole Russia scam thing to be able to have an attorney general, the chief law enforcement officer, as Jeff Sessions said, for the international divisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whereas Jeff Sessions is the attorney general for the domestic divisions. Now, they couldn't come right out and tell the people of this country that we have an attorney general that is the chief law enforcement officer for the international rule of law,
mm-hmm.
because that would give away the whole game, right, of transfer of sovereignty to the global governing system.
Yeah, and they can't actually ask real questions. I mean, all Sessions would have had to done here, all he would have had to do is just say, We don't need a special prosecutor. We don't need a special counsel, I should say.
Well, we don't with the storyline that they gave us, but with the story that I just told you and the audience about the international divisions
right.
that are within the Department of Justice, they do need an attorney general for those international divisions because they are international law enforcement. Yeah.
Yeah. Here's just to give you that. And the thing is none of these Congress, I mean, they can't be that stupid. I think they know full well what they're doing. Oh, they're absolutely being dishonest. They're putting on a show for the C-SPAN cameras. That's all it is. By pounding the table, demanding special counsel, demanding that they go after the Clintons. when they know full well this is all a game, folks. She's not going to prison. Bill Clinton is not going to prison. None of these people are going to be gone after and pursued, because these people all know this is all a tongue-in-cheek game that they're playing. And here's somebody, let's see, this is a congressman on a news program explaining what the criteria are for a special counsel.
On the issue of special counsel, I did not sign. Jim Jordan's a great friend. I have tremendous respect for him. I did not sign the letter because I don't think the threshold has been met for the appointment of special counsel. And I think this is a really important point. You can investigate something without special counsel. In fact, 99.9% of all investigations in this country are done by the women and men at the Department of Justice and the U.S. Attorney's offices, and none of them is called special counsel. So there's a threshold that has to be met, and I don't think it has been met. So to say we're not going to appoint special counsel is not to say we're not going to look into something. We're just not going to do it.
Very, very interesting. Jim Jordan says it's obvious.
Now he cuts him right off. See, you're revealing the game. Cuts him right off when he's in the middle. He's explaining. They don't need a special counsel. And he jumps right in there, doesn't he?
Yeah, well, that's because they're talking about two different things, actually. The special counsel in the traditional sense, that law expired. There isn't even a law anymore that allows a special counsel like Mueller. Hmm. So, but they don't want to give away the global game of transfer of sovereignty, the laws that govern us, to a global governing system. They don't want the American people to know that.
Interesting. So, well, a little follow-up from last week regarding the Pope. Remember, we were talking about the declaration on the... What was it called? The Declaration on the Doctrine of Justification. This is the little doctrine. In fact, if you missed that broadcast, you need to go back and listen again, or listen to it. It's in the archives. But it looks like the Protestant churches are being merged with the Vatican. And that justification doctrine declaration on the doctrine of a justification is an agreement signed between the Vatican and the Protestant churches. At least the Methodist and Lutheran, I think, signed on to it. And this is very worrying. But I see televangelists like Kenneth Copeland pushing this onto their congregations. And so, just to illustrate, and we were talking about it last week, you know, how Kenneth Copeland said, I met with the Pope, and he had a wonderful spirit about him. Blah blah blah. So just to illustrate what's wrong with the Vatican for a minute, LifeNews.com. Pope Francis: abortion is a sin that results in killing children. Well, I agree with that. But then the very next article, also from LifeNews.com: Vatican co-hosts event with Planned Parenthood board member and euthanasia advocates. What's going on here? We know the Vatican is all about promoting sustainable development. It's all about the UN agenda. So I just wanted to mention that briefly, and it will be brief in the interest of time, because we're running out of time already. It's unbelievable. But I want to get to this Bush Institute forum, Vicki. And I was going to cover some Zimbabwe stuff, but I guess I'll let that ride. In the interest of time, you said
I don't know, that forum might fold into it, because that they're all about, you know, the National Endowment for Democracy and all of the things that we can do for Africa and all the developing countries. Go ahead, though.
I wouldn't be a bit surprised to find that the State Department had a hand in this. Now, I was reading an article out of the Daily Mail, and I'll put that in the show notes, but it turns out China has done a lot of investment in Zimbabwe. They've built their,
they're
built their parliament
all over Africa, all over the world,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah, they really are. It's astounding. They built their parliament building. They've been building hydroelectric dams. And it's, you know, in return, they're given access to the diamond mines there, which apparently have turned out to be very lucrative. But they're pouring FDI money into all these countries. And so,
and our transportation secretary, when she said that that they were looking for foreign direct investment for our transportation system, she had in mind the communist Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And they are putting in ports and inland ports and all kinds of transportation infrastructure all over the world because they have a plan. What is it called? One world, one road, or
one. It's yeah. I know what you're talking about. One road, many paths. I'll have to look it up. I know exactly
what
you're.
I'll have to find it because I have it too. A guy has been sending me. He's been writing about it on a website, and it's really a well done website.
It's one road, one belt. One road, one belt, isn't it?
Oh, maybe that's it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's huge. We should probably dive into that a little bit more. But you sent me a video from the George W. Bush Institute, which featured former Secretaries of State Madeleine Halfbright and Condoleezza Rice and the current Ambassador for Peace, Nikki Haley, at the UN. Amanda Schnetzer was the Bush Institute moderator. They were talking about freedom and democracy, promoting you know, that around the world. Big promotion of the U.S. warmongering diplomats. You know, that's really what they are. Anyway, here's Nikki Haley.
When I first got there, we obviously had issues, but the one that was really defining was when the president made the decision to hit Syria, and after the chemical weapons, when he made that decision. The number of calls and emails I received from countries saying, it's so good to see America lead again.
Hey, you know, that's what America does, baby.
You know why? Because we go blow up countries and destroy them, and then we rebuild them, and Silicon Valley and the tech industry makes a fortune.
Yeah, it's great for business.
It sure is.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was amazing, and it was enlightening.
Amazing.
Because they felt like we had been dormant, and they really feel weaker when the U.S. doesn't lead. They want to see us speak out.
They want to see us kill people.
To weigh in. They want us to lead on the international stage, and when we do, they feel more confident. And
mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, you're seeing that whether it's with Japan and South Korea on the North Korea issue, you're seeing that whether it's with the, you know, our Arab partners when we're dealing with Iran, all of those things. Whether it's Venezuela or Cuba, I think it's always going to be important for us to know the power of our voice and also know what leadership means to the world.
And the power of our bombs.
Right. And the reason why, I don't know if you picked this up or not, but the reason why they did that forum is because Trump is cutting the budget for the State Department and he's cutting back the UN, not by a substantial amount, mind you,
mm-hmm.
But he is cutting it back.
I knew he was cutting back the budget for the State Department, but
the
military budget, however, is not being
cut. The UN is 25%, but it had gone up to, they were spending up to 28%.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was just cutting it back to 25% to where it should be by law. So.
Yeah, well, if they cut it all together, it wouldn't bother me any. I mean, really,
we need to get out of the UN and kick them out of our country, is what I think.
Absolutely. Go there, lock them up. I said it before. Raid the building with the military, lock them up, put them all in cuffs, stuff them and cuff them, put them in a hole, and fill the hole in with dirt. You know, I mean.
Well, the whole thing has become a scam. It's just, it is a financial crime syndicate. You know, they have our military go bomb countries, you know, because of some alleged chemical attack that Assad did against his own people. Mm-hmm. I don't think so.
No.
I think probably they're UN operatives, maybe even the White Hats, who did the attack. They get the U.S. then to go bomb the country, and then there is the rebuilding part of it.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, there are all the refugees, and the refugees then either go to Europe or come to the United States. It's like a mechanism to conquer us from within.
Absolutely it is. Now, of course, you can't have a group of diplomats getting together and talking peace and stability without blaming the Russians. And what's telling to me about this is that we have these three so-called diplomats, each from different administrations, different parties, you know, and they're playing the same Russian blame game, including Nikki Haley, who was appointed by Trump to her post presently. She's going right along with the whole Russian hacking meme.
But what has happened now is the rapidity of the technological spread is just remarkable, and cyber that we don't fully understand, and what it is that those who
I believe this is Madeleine Albright here, but Nikki Haley jumps in.
Don't like us can affect with cyber. Condi was talking about NATO. When on the 60th anniversary of NATO, I was asked to lead a new strategic concept for the new Secretary General. And one of the things we talked about was whether a cyber threat was an Article 5 threat, because Estonia's banking system had been brought down.
Okay, now let me jump in here and explain Article 5 is that clause in NATO where if it's common defense, it deals with a common defense. If one of us is attacked, it's like we were all attacked and we're all going to come to that country's defense. That's Article 5.
And at that stage, people were kind of nervous, saying we don't really know the genesis and what do we do. I think now we understand that a cyber threat can bring a state down. There's also the usage of cyber and technology to undermine systems. And one of the things, and as chairman of NDI, I have just come from Georgia and Ukraine. And in Ukraine, I was briefed by people that showed what the Russians have been doing to undermine the system there through fake news. And they were able to penetrate in a number of ways and take a piece of a story and turn it around. So, for instance, Ukraine is a very complex country, and the western part during World War II, they were some that worked with the Germans because of what the Soviets had done to them. So all of a sudden, there were stories in the Ukrainian paper about the fact that all of western Ukraine were Nazis. And so they took pieces of information and pushed it. And I think we have to recognize that we are dealing with a president of a country of Russia who is a KGB agent, and they know how to do propaganda. And what they're doing is using information in a way to undermine the system, democracy. What they want to do is undermine the democracies in Europe and separate us from Europe. And I do believe that they have figured out how to make our life more complicated in every single way through various new methods, tweets and bots and various aspects.
Tweets and bots.
And we are an open society, and they are using our openness. And how do we deal with it without closing down? So it is a challenge for all of us to think through, but it has changed because we are being attacked in a new way through a new system. And it's very interesting because the Russian chairman of their joint chiefs, of their general staff, Gerasimov, has in fact developed a doctrine about this. It's hybrid warfare, and here their military guy has kind of put it together in the way that they plan to reassert themselves in a variety of places in the world.
Now, here is the problem they're laying out. Now, of course, I would just add to that that if your country is if your country has the capability of being brought down, like she's saying here, if you have the ability, they have the ability, an adversary, to bring your country down through cyber, then you've made yourself way too vulnerable by having too much stuff exposed to cyber.
That's right.
You're way too dependent upon it if, in fact, and so if that's the case, why are we doing more of the same thing? And I come back to the smart grid. If does it make any sense to have electricity controlled through networks that are vulnerable to hacking and ultimately completely taking off the whole thing offline. This is the kind of insanity as they exposed all of these threats. And, oh, this is a danger. This could happen. And what do? We do exactly more of it. More of the same stuff.
Right. Well, you know what their problem is that in this particular time, because we're talking about technology, logic applies. And what you just gave there was the logical analysis. Well, if they can take our country down with cyber, then we better not be dependent on cyber. We better be able to go manual immediately and have backup manual systems.
Yes. That would be the logical thing to do.
Yeah. But see, as we talked about before, the Department of Home Scam Security and the military, they want cyber
commands. A global cyber command.
Cyber command.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
So we have a global cyber command for global governance, and it's all really controlled by the tech industry.
And I think if it doesn't move to the point where they are able to get it moving, you know, as rapidly or as good, if it gets stuck somehow, I wouldn't put it past them for having us false flag to get things, you know, kickstart the process again.
They've been doing false flags, I really think that's what all the false flags were. That's why I wrote that piece, Budget Time is Terror Time. Because they need to have a terror attack to justify the technocratic systems that they want to implement, because the cost of those systems is mind-boggling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they've blown out our whole economic system with the technology that they've been implementing here and around the world. It's not just our country where they're implementing this technology. And what Madeleine Albright, when she said NDI, what she was talking about was the National Democratic Institute, which is one of the institutes for the National Endowment for Democracy.
Okay.
And they have been interfering in elections.
Yes.
And in the social life of countries all over the world since 1982 when it was created.
But
or
you
1983.
See, it's fine when we do it. It's fine when the State Department does it.
Yeah,
but
sure.
When those evil Russians do anything, by George, we got to do something about this. Talk about hypocrisy. Condoleezza Rice picks it up and then brings it back to the agenda, which is exactly what you were just talking about.
You know, I've done some work to look back when I was a student at what some of the Soviet efforts to influence fifth columns and so forth, and actually they were kind of clumsy. And this isn't clumsy. This is highly sophisticated. I will say that I hope we are on top of what really happened to us, that we're really investigating it in ways that bring all of our tools, including what people at places like Google and Apple will, Google and Facebook will know about how this is done.
Okay, I got to pause it here for just a moment and remind people. I sound like a broken record, but for new listeners who haven't heard this before, there is no evidence, despite the various people, and it's not a consensus, by the way, in the intelligence, quote-unquote, community, that we were hacked in the first place. There are dissenters. But this is something that has been a meme for a long time now, at least the last year, you know, since the election happened. And, oh, the Russians hacked the election. The Russians interfered, blah, blah, blah. And they go on, and we've talked about it ad nauseum, that it's impossible to prove an origin of an attack. You can go on IP addresses, but IP addresses can be spoofed. And then what they're pointing to are, well, this is the kind of style of attack. This is the methodology that the Russians would use, blah, blah, blah. They're talking out of their hind end, folks. But to see these supposed diplomats go along with this And because they're agenda pushers. They're pushing the agenda.
And then we've got to fix it. Because my own view is, if they do this to us once, it's their fault. If they do this to us twice, it's ours.
We got to fix it.
And so a national effort to figure out what happened here and then to stop it the next time is going to be very important. And Madeline said the right thing. We have to do it without shutting ourselves down. Absolutely. But we need better cooperation between the private sector and the government on this. Sometimes out where I live in the Silicon Valley, people talk about privacy. We all want to protect privacy, but we also want to protect the country, and that conversation is not going on in a very effective way. There's too much suspicion between government and the private sector. And I'll say one other thing. You know, I know the Europeans worry a lot about privacy and some of the things that they believe American intelligence agencies may have done in their countries.
Like spying
on
you?
Whatever differences we have with the Europeans about privacy pale in comparison to the differences that we have with Russia or China. And so I hope that the Europeans will be a part of this conversation as well.
Uh-huh. That's the global cyber command. We got to have the Europeans.
Okay. Let me just interject here and back up and recall when General Gerasimov was mentioned and his article on hybrid warfare.
Mm-hmm.
Well, our equivalent to that was Admiral Art Sobrowski, and he's considered to be the father of net-centric warfare. And the revolution in military affairs, out of that came a report that was the new American way of war.
Mm-hmm.
So General Gerasimov's report is probably just their figuring out what was being done to them on the American side.
Okay, hang on
and
right
I
there.
Would,
let's pick
I
it up
put
after
money
the break.
On it.
Yeah, let's pick it up after the break. We'll be back, folks. All right, we're in the home stretch of the broadcast here. This is Government America. Vicki, did you say what you wanted to say about Gerasimov or whatever his name was?
Well, Gerasimov is the Russian guy, Art Sobrowski, Admiral Art, is considered to be the father of net-centric warfare, and he started talking about it in the late 1990s.
Okay.
So the Russian general, his article is very recent, like within the last year or two. And so I think it's just the Russians figuring out what people in our country, what our military, what our tech companies did to them.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I think you're right. I have one more clip from this, forum, which there could be a lot more lifted from that. They got into free trade later on in the thing, but in the forum. But I did want to break away to another congressional hearing. But first, this is Nikki Haley also pretending like the Russian hack is a foregone conclusion.
You know, and I find it fascinating because the Russians, God bless them, they're saying, why are Americans anti-Russian and why have we done the sanctions? Well, don't interfere in our elections. And we won't be anti-Russian. And I think we have to be so hard on this. And we have to hold them accountable. And we have to get the private sector to understand they are responsible for this, too. We all have to step up from this event. We can't.
Now, you notice the theme. It's the private sector. The government and the private sector. Government and the private sector. We talk all the time on this show about how the two are being fused together. And this is really what you have when you have when you're trying to form a technocratic tyranny, the government and private sector fusing together as one. It's the private sector that's going to be involved in running this global cyber command.
Yes, absolutely. And
you're cutting out again.
Oh.
Go ahead, say it.
Okay, economic sanctions is what she's talking about. So the U.S. puts economic sanctions on countries so that they can only buy supposedly what are the essential items.
Mm-hmm.
So who does that hurt? That hurts the people of the country. They then, our government then sends in the NGOs to agitate against the human rights violations of the country, you know, like as in Syria, mm-hmm. or Iraq, or you name a country, you know, and that's the way the U.S. works this game, this scam. Mm-hmm. And it's disgusting. It's so disgusting how they're working this. Then, you know, in the public arena, they talk about the abuses of that evil government, whichever one it is.
Whichever what it is.
Squeeze on them.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah.
So
anyway,
and then what happens is it causes a turmoil because of the insurgency that our government creates with the NGOs, and you know, once the country blows up like we talked about before, then the tech industries and the construction industries can go in and rebuild the country.
Yeah,
and it's our tax dollars. Our tax dollars are paying for the whole thing, while all of the profits from it go to these private companies.
Right, and you know, we were talking about Zimbabwe a little earlier. The only reason why this coup d'état took place in the first place, and they're very careful not to call it a coup d'état. I could have played some audio from the State Department where they're, you know, talking about, you know, the question was repeatedly asked. And Heather Nauert refused to answer the question. She just wouldn't. She kept sidestepping it, whether or not this was a coup d'etat. But, I mean, this guy, this Mugabe, he's a murderous scumbag. I mean, bloodthirsty dictator. And this guy, he's been allowed to be in power up until... You know, his wife threatened to bring down the empire and threatened the business involvement that the other countries were involved in there. She's threatened to rock the boat. That's why he was ousted. It had nothing to do with who he was. They don't care about the people. They don't care about the white farmers that were ordered to leave their farms. You know, they don't care about the people being murdered there. No. Has nothing to do with that. Has everything to do with the business involvement.
And we have to get the private sector to understand they are responsible for this too. We all have to step up from this event. We can't just assume that that's going to happen again. And I will tell you that when a country can come interfere in another country's elections, that is warfare.
There you go. There's how it's being defined.
Certainly is, and we've been doing it since 1983.
All right, there are other things about the conference, as I said, I was found interesting, but I want to break away from it for now, because we were, what we're playing dovetails perfectly with a congressional session. The House Subcommittee on Information Technology held a hearing not too long ago on political advertisements, and I know you watched this hearing, as did I, Vicky. It was the same topic. They were exploring ways to mitigate foreign actors from having influence in the American election system. There was a lot of talk about regulating Google and Facebook, and that should by itself alarm every American, not because we care about those particular platforms, but if they can regulate them, they can regulate all websites. And that's what I really think we're headed here, is a highly regulated internet. David Shavern of the News Media Alliance, a nonprofit who represents 2,000 newspapers, is among those who are really pushing for Facebook and Google regulations.
Our journalists and publishers are also held to high standards. Not only are we potentially liable for knowingly publishing something that's false, our very brands are built on trust with our readers. Because of this, our commitment to truthful and accurate reporting has also informed our approach to advertising. When it comes to political advertisements, the legal responsibility for complying with Federal Election Commission rules clearly falls on the advertiser. Nonetheless, news publishers have taken an active role in ensuring that proper disclosures are made and that all ads placed in our publications reflect the honesty and integrity that's the foundation of our brands. As technology has evolved, publishers have carried forward our responsibility to provide accurate content and the internal controls that go with that to our digital products. These efforts are now much more difficult because of the growth of online platforms like Google and Facebook that act as intermediaries in the distribution of news, content, and advertising. Publishers previously worked to ensure the integrity of both their content and the advertising that appeared next to it, but now we have less control over advertising because of programmatic delivery of ads through ad tech platforms. These challenges are largely caused by the massive growth and inability to control an ecosystem that was built with a specific intention of not exercising responsibility over the integrity of content or the advertising that sustains its foundation. This is exacerbated by the fact that Google and Facebook now control the distribution and monetization of online news and information.
And there's what he's really complaining about.
They are the top two sources of traffic for online news publishers. They also collect most of the revenue, with Google and Facebook receiving approximately 71% of all digital advertising dollars in the United States last year, which includes political advertising. News publishers have worked tirelessly to respond to rapidly changing business models. My members now represent some of the most innovative and engaging digital publishers in existence, and we have created these new businesses without compromising the integrity of our journalism. It is time that Google and Facebook and other online platforms do their part as well. And while they have profited greatly from their immense market power, they have yet to accept the full responsibility that comes with that position. When it comes to political advertising, Congress also needs to make the same adjustments that the rest of the economy is making and move away from a platform-specific perspective. My members deliver their news content wherever their readers want it, on desktops, in print, mobile devices, and even wearables. Within the bounds of the First Amendment, if Congress sees fit to impose requirements on certain kinds of political speech, then those rules shouldn't be defined by the delivery platform. And as a corollary, Congress should revisit the need for current platform-specific requirements to see if they appropriately apply to our converged digital world. If Congress continues to legislate by platform, then technology will simply continue to outpace the rules. The Alliance believes that the FEC rules should be updated to require disclosures within an Internet advertisement to identify the sponsor of an ad. Google and Facebook should also update their ad-driven business models and the opaque algorithms that accelerate the distribution of so-called fake news and viral messaging so that high-quality, reputable content is elevated in search and news feeds.
I thought it was quite ironic that he's calling for Congress to regulate all platforms equally. You know,
right. So we can have Pravda USA.
Mm-hmm.
How do you define political speech? If I put up an article about immigration, well, that it's a political issue.
Yes.
So am I engaging in political speech?
And that is the problem. What is an ad? What constitutes an ad? A lot of these ads, I mean, they're accelerated posts. For instance, on Twitter, and I think probably Facebook too, you can pay to have a post elevated. And Twitter, it's called a tweet. But you can pay to have that seen by people that don't follow you. It shows up on their timeline, and it does say promoted at the bottom, but you have to be really paying attention to see it, to look for it. But what constitutes an ad? That's the problem. And we're getting into an area here where we're talking about regulating all online speech. That's really the bottom line here.
Right, and that's my objection to the walled gardens of content,
mm-hmm.
because it will be much easier to control speech if they have you in a corral, so to speak.
Yes.
So that they
can
what you can see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my career is in the broadcast industry, and each station is required to maintain a public file, which includes a political file that has a record of all political candidates' ads with the amount paid for each ad. Now, that's not required by newspapers for newspapers. So it's a little bit hypocritical of this guy to be pushing for all platforms to be regulated like broadcast, to be regulated equally. They haven't had to deal with the FCC. They haven't had to deal with any other federal regulatory body. In fact, if anybody even talks about any regulation for newspapers, it's the end of the world. They're screaming. Yet he's calling for regulations for internet companies because he doesn't like the fact that they're biting into his profits. That's really what it boils down to. And even though the hearing wasn't really about it, this David Chevern seems to be pushing real hard for some sort of barrier on what he calls so-called fake news. And here's an interaction he had with Representative Robin Kelly.
Besides lax self-regulation of advertising appearing on social media, there's also the proliferation of fake accounts. On Election Day, thousands of fake accounts coordinated messages aimed at disparaging Secretary Clinton and Democrats. Mr. Chevern, print media still contains a large amount of advertising. What are its responsibilities in terms of political advertising?
Well, its responsibilities are those that it's traditionally had and upheld, which is to develop a safe and trusting environment for its readers. The most of our content is now delivered digitally, and the biggest things we can do there are let people know where the information has come from. What is the source of the information? The biggest issue, from my perspective, with quote-unquote fake news is that it comes out of nowhere, people don't know where it comes from, and it's fed to them in the same way that other legitimate news is fed to them. So the best thing that any platform or news source can do is be clear about where the news is coming from, what the source of it is.
Just out of curiosity, do you, with print media, do you feel like, you said you want to provide a safe and trusting, do you feel like most of your readers feel that way or trust what they read?
I think they do find it is, we have an extremely loyal and actually growing audience for our news product. The audience for our news product is bigger than it's ever been in history across all the platforms. And the fact of the matter is people want credible information about the world and their communities, and they primarily come to us to get it.
Wants to restrict the market.
Yes.
From new entrants.
Absolutely.
But you know what the fallacy here is that newspapers for a long time have accepted articles from public relations.
Yes.
Which means that it's basically an advertisement that isn't labeled as such.
Yeah, and they used to put like an advertisement even if it was a story that looked like it could be legitimate. They used to put, you know, paid advertisement somewhere on there. Now they're not even bothering to do that. I mean, it's the native ads have become the norm now.
Yeah.
Both, not only in print, but also in the broadcast industry, too. They'll do stories now on certain products. Hey, an exciting new product, blah, blah, blah. But it's a paid ad.
Mm-hmm.
And the big networks are doing this, too, now.
Yeah. And even sponsoring programs,
yeah,
you know, that lead you to think a particular way. So it really is more of an advertisement or social messaging rather than a program.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for entertainment. So
can do to do a better job helping readers distinguish between the real news and content that comes from questionable sources or the fake news.
I mean, there's always been crazy conspiracy theories. I think we've all got uncles over the Thanksgiving dinner who's told us crazy stuff. But that's always been different from the newspaper on your driveway or what's on TV. What's happened now is that it all gets put in a blender and fed to you so that the real news sources and the crazy conspiracy theories come the same way. You don't want the platforms or anybody else censoring content, but you need to give readers more information. You need to indicate much more clearly where it's coming from, and these algorithms to which we are all subject to in our lives need to give credit to people who actually pay reporters for real reporting.
Okay, so many of the sites that this guy would refer to as fake news or conspiracy theory sites, they actually do pay their reporters to file reports. What he's really saying is that he only wants the First Amendment to apply to his newspapers. Only people with his narrative should be allowed to be considered a legitimate news operation.
Right, and George Soros can afford to hire 1,000 reporters.
Absolutely.
Giving them a paycheck. That doesn't make what they write true.
Absolutely, it doesn't. And that creates the problem. How do you determine what's a legitimate news outfit? How do you determine what constitutes fake news? And most important of all, who gets to decide?
It appears to me that a number of the individuals testifying today are conflating general or social ads, opinion posts, admittedly political ads, and explicit political campaign ads, and conflating them all as being the same thing. As Mr. Rothenberg notes, there were a lot of sophisticated posts, I'm quoting, about social political issues, some of which were made widely available by operators, including those outside the United States. Now, let me ask you, Mr. Chafin, how are we going to determine what's fake news and real news? Who determines that for us?
Well, I wouldn't ask the platforms to determine it. I mean, fake news...
No, that doesn't answer my question, sir. Who determines that? If we're going to say we're going to stop fake news in some manner in America, and trust me, I'm not a... You should see my Facebook post. It's not exactly a wonderful thing to read some days, trust me. So who's going to determine what is fake news and stop it?
No one's going to determine what's fake news. There's a pre-existing... I agree with you that conflating political ads with bad content is incorrect. And there is a pre-existing regulatory regime about political ads.
Well, let me go on.
Okay, and then on the quote-unquote fake news front, there's a twofold problem. People get garbage over their news feeds online in the same way that good information is delivered to them.
I only have five minutes, sir. Let me ask the next question for you, which is a number of the newspapers that you represent printed a variety of articles about the upcoming tax reform and tax cut bill that's pending. They quoted a variety of sources as being that the rich are going to benefit, that the majority of the tax cuts are going to be for the rich, and quoted some sources. Did you detail the funding sources of those groups that made that quote?
With regard to those pieces or other pieces, you know who to complain to. You can complain to the publisher or the reporters. Most of what we're talking about are things that cannot be attributed.
With all due respect, no newspaper in my community reported any of those sources. And in fact, as it comes to the tax bill that's pending, the tax brackets have not been published. The bill's not been published. Yet somehow, if you read the newspapers in my community, they've already determined how the tax bill is going to work based upon some groups that are funded by, I'll admit, progressive left groups that say immediately any tax cut's going to be bad. So my question for you is, if we're going to start being fair in terms of the information put out, would you not be responsible for posting that this comes from a group that's largely funded by, pick whatever term you want to do, would you not post what their bias is? Why would you not do that then if you want to talk about it?
Congressman, what I would say is that you know who to complain to, which is the publisher and the reporters whose names are attached to that content.
Well,
as opposed to most of what we're talking about today.
I assure you that it hasn't had much difference. The distinction I want to suggest to your group is that there's a difference between you're responsible for the people you employ, their opinions they put forward. You know very clearly in opinion ads or opinion columns who the writer is. I've done a number of them. You're responsible for that contact, or the individual that makes their ad, their opinion piece is responsible for the content. That's clear. The difference is on the internet and internet posts that the provider, the intermediary, is not responsible for it. They didn't write it. They didn't hire them. They didn't determine who they are. Yet you want them held to a standard that's like your newspaper, and it's an entirely different format.
I wouldn't assert that, Congressman.
You did in your testimony, with all due respect.
Saying you can complain to the publisher about an opinion piece or an article in a newspaper is very intellectually dishonest of this guy.
Really, you can, in my local newspaper, you
can
get 300 words, one letter per month.
Well, a reader must be first aware that something is disinformation before they can complain. That's point number one.
Even
then, it would do no good because the papers are under no obligation to be in the public interest, quote unquote, like the broadcast licensed stations are required to be. The way the broadcast industry must be, I talked about the public file. You know, you have that public file, and things have to be held there. Complaints are go to the FCC, and if you get enough complaints, you can be fined or ultimately lose your license. Now, it doesn't happen. I've never really known anybody to for it to happen, but it is one thing broadcast stations used to worry a lot about. The very nature of propaganda is that it's deceptive. So well-done propaganda, it always renders its audience unable to complain. to anyone if they don't realize they're being lied to. This is a fundamental First Amendment issue, Vicky. And it makes me very nervous to hear Congress essentially debating the limitation of free speech. But this is where we are in America today.
Yeah.
It's frightening.
And another thing is, earlier in that clip you had, somebody was, Nikki Haley, talking about how the corporations need to be responsible.
Yeah.
Well, it's not really the corporation. You know, we don't have loyalty to corporations. It's our government that's supposed to be responsible. And if they're not, then you know, what are they doing?
Yeah, what are they doing? I don't know. They're destroying the country is what they're doing. Hey, let me go ahead and knock out this call real quick, who's been on hold for a little bit. Sorry, we just got so much crap to get to. Go ahead, caller. You're on the air.
Oh, I wouldn't call it crap.
Well, that's crap.
This is Daniel in Fremont.
Yeah,
Region 9.
Only have a couple minutes left, so if you can get right to it there.
Okay,
sorry about
quick.
That.
I just have two quick things.
Okay.
One is your bumper song. What is the first word? Is it root for the restoration of our nation?
Truth.
Oh, truth. Okay, I couldn't make out that first word. Okay, the other thing is just I think that I missed out. I don't have cable anymore, but I think that... C-SPAN, really, I was listening to it too seriously. It's really a comedy channel. You got all these people on there who know nothing about what they're talking about, trying to say how they're going to control this and control that and regulate this and regulate that, and they have no idea. None of these people could get a real job.
Yeah, it's a show.
It's really a comedy.
It's a show.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's been true about the internet since its inception. Congress facilitated all of this. They took our tax dollars to pay for all of this, and the reinvention of our government. And they had no idea what it was that they were doing. Absolutely none.
Yeah. And yet, the call is always for more regulation. Oh, we need to regulate this. We need to regulate that.
Yep.
And who's going to regulate it? These ignoramuses, these greedy, ignorant fools who can't regulate their own lives.
Yeah.
Well, the whole regulatory structure has been turned on its head. They can't regulate corporations, so they're regulating people. That's what they're doing.
Exactly. And they're not even doing a good job at that. The one thing we have going for us is government can't do anything right. I hear the music.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Thanks for your show.
Yeah.
That's okay. Bye-bye.
Yeah, thanks. Sorry, Daniel. Hopefully we'll have more time next week. There's a lot to get to, but I'd like to pick up some with this hearing next week as well, because I think this is important, and we only got about halfway through a lot of the stuff that we have here. It's just never enough time. But, you know, at least we have the professional cuddlers. If we get depressed, you know, we can always fall back.
Good to know.
Yeah, keep it in mind. Yeah, you know, gotta keep that, you know, open mind about things. Anyway, we gotta go. We're out of time. Thanks, Vicky. Okay. Thanks, listeners.
Thank you for this, Darren. Republic. Bye, everybody.
Do what you can to restore it, and join us back here next week. We'll be here, Lord willing, and we hope you will be too. Bye-bye.